Today's show is sponsored by Audible, and today's novel, Dune, by Frank Herbert, is available on audible.com. This performance of Dune is read by Scott Breck, one of my personal favorite narrators of all time. He does a fantastic job with all the characters and the accents and makes everything extremely believable. I think you'll really enjoy it. You can get a free trial of audible.com's service by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell. I'm joined by my wife, Sarah, and our good friends, Samantha and Andrew. Today we're talking about Dune by Frank Herbert. Published in 1965, this epic space fiction novel was originally released as two separate serials in Analog magazine. According to the Sci-Fi Channel and PNN online polling, this novel has sold well over 12 million copies, making it the world's best-selling science fiction novel. Now, warning, during today's discussion, there will be spoilers. We'll be discussing the novel in its entirety, as well as several of the novels from A Song of Ice and Fire. So if you haven't read Dune or A Song of Ice and Fire, you may want to save this podcast for a later date. So I'd like to start just kind of with the general overall story. Of course, it's epic fiction, and we have warring families. It's very political, but at the same time, action-packed. I picked it up just because it felt like it was something that I'd heard about. Of course, I'd seen bits and pieces of the movie, but never in its entirety, and read it for the first time about 10 years ago. Picked it up again about 6 months ago or so, and thoroughly enjoyed it very much, so much so that I thought that we should be discussing it today. Samantha, let me ask you, how did you come to be acquainted with the book?
Actually, I had seen the movie. The movie popped on TV not that long ago, and the movie, in my opinion, was awful. Like, it was horribly boring. I couldn't keep up with anything. But that line, that one line, based on the novel by, always mm-hmm. gets me. I always assume the book's got to be better than this, because the story seemed like it was pretty good. So that's how I got it. That's how I got exposed to it, was checking out the terrible movie, which inspired me, you know, based on the story, it inspired me to take a look at the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the book, for me, was definitely a tough read. I think when I reread it, when I go through it a second time, I'll be able to grasp a little more of the story. But it's amazing. There's some really good stuff going on in Dune. A lot of characters and things like that I found myself getting really immersed in.
It's thick, though, right? Like, not physically thick, but it's thick.
Yeah, like, plot-wise and character-wise, it's like, Herbert's just throwing all those characters at you just one after another, and you're reading from so many different viewpoints that thick is definitely a good way to describe this.
Yes.
This.
Mm.
I felt like I struggled.
Now let me ask this. Has anybody who's here today read anything other than the first book?
No.
No, I have not.
Yeah, neither have I.
Although I'd like to.
Mm-hmm. I have been told the original trilogy, the next two, is what really is good.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Hmm. Yeah.
No, I would like to.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, as a fan of the science fiction fantasy genre, I've heard of Dune. I've seen Dune referenced in shows and cartoons and...
And we'll get into that.
Yeah. General Society for a long time. And I feel like, I really should read this. I should know.
Right.
Outside of this general something about spice business that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's how I came across it, too. It was kind of like one of those foundational readings for science sci-fi.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, if you're a little nerdy, you should know your stuff about Dune, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I must be a bad nerd, because I've been reading sci-fi for 100 years, and I just never felt... I never really... Maybe it's just because it is so commonplace. I never noticed references to Dune anywhere. And then now, of course, that I've started it, and that I've been reading it for the past few weeks and all, now I see the references everywhere.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's just something that I didn't notice before, but... You know, I didn't realize how big and how much of a foundation novel for the genre that, you know, this one is.
Mm-hmm. So let me go ahead and talk about the references now. My two favorite references are the Iron Maiden song To Tame a Land, which is basically just a retelling of the story in song form. Have any of you guys heard that before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a terrific song. In addition to that music, Fatboy Slim's Weapon of Choice mentions very specifically, if you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a Dune reference. See, there's another one.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
Another one that pops to that song.
Up. Word for word, walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm.
Yeah.
I love it.
And then, of course, Sarah, you mentioned cartoons. You want to tell us what cartoon you're talking about?
I'm talking about Futurama, but mm-hmm. I can't I can't say the specific episode.
I don't know exactly what episode it was, but it was on Amy's parents' farm. They're riding worms around.
The Bugalos.
Something like that, yeah.
Right, yeah.
So what about everybody else? What other references have you noticed make mention of Dune? Anything specific?
Well, generally, I noticed the Futurama one only because I recently saw it, and I realized it when I saw it, but I would not have known the reference had I not read the book.
I like... I usually make notes when I'm reading something, and I have what I know, something about spices, currency, and sandworms. So, yeah, sandworms.
There's a show on HBO called Togetherness, and it's a recently released show. I think there's only one, or maybe there's two seasons out now, but they do an entire episode where they recreate a play form of the book because they're so obsessed with the book, and they're kind of like older nerds who like read it when they were younger. It's a pretty fantastic show.
Is that live action or is that animated?
Yeah, it's live action.
We might have to watch that.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I remember seeing that, and I thought that was really entertaining. The other movie, Safety Not Guaranteed, is like an indie film that came out a couple years ago as well. And those same guys did that, just in case if anyone wants to reference that. But yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't Star Wars like a big one? I don't know a lot because I haven't seen all the Star Wars movies. All of them. I know, terrible me. But I read somewhere that Star Wars was somewhat or partially inspired by Dune or something like
that. Yeah, somewhat. Yeah. No, it's true. I think that there was definitely kind of, because at least for the Star Wars aspect of it, when Lucas was describing what like motivated him, I mean, there was kind of like the Western component to the sci-fi genre that he felt absent and really wanted to incorporate that in. So I think Dune definitely laid a foundation for that, obviously, because of the entire planet being a desert.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was interesting for me. The other thing that I was thinking about in terms of the book, at least for influencing the sci-fi genre, it was, for me, all the books that I read, aside from that, like Isaac Asimov, Philip K. Dick, all that stuff, they really lay into the technology that exists in the universe that they've created.
Yes.
And here it's much more about the people. And interestingly enough, like they talk about obviously the technology that exists on the planets, everything along those lines. But at the end of the day, it's like it makes you kind of like reflect upon like Romeo and Juliet, like houses existing and then these confrontations between people and like how they interact with each other. And so there's a very humanistic component that I thought I at least was absent in a lot of other sci-fi novels. And so that's why, at least from my perspective, why it kind of serves as a foundation for the area.
No, I agree. I think it was a different take on many novels that I've read. Now, Russ, you already mentioned A Song of Ice and Fire, and they're definitely reminiscent. And I think it is a bit of that, here's another world that we're introducing you to, but I'm not going to tell you a lot about the technology or exactly what their capabilities are. I'm going to tell you about the people, and if the technology fits in, it'll be there.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, were you saying something similar to that about Star Wars?
I just thought that I had remember reading somewhere that Star Wars was like was partially inspired by Dune, or there's a lot of like inspiration in the way that characters are developed and some of the scenery that was borrowed from Dune, that like George Lucas had borrowed a lot of inspiration from Dune.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough to be an expert on that, only because I haven't really seen all the Star Wars. I've only seen a few of the Star Wars movies. I don't even know if I've seen, you know, the first one that was released all the way through. So I'm a bad nerd.
Well, there's lots of different flavors of nerd. I understand entirely. Well, as far as Star Wars go, what I would say is that, of course, I'm sure they're both inspired by mythology in general, and I'm sure Lucas took some of the imagery in general. I imagine the thing that strikes me is what you just mentioned was that the technology kind of takes a back seat. I mean, Star Wars in many ways is fantasy, not science fiction, and so you have a lot of terms being bandied about, technobabble, but it's not even remote. It's very, very watered down. It's very short. The scene I'm thinking about is when Han Solo is talking about the Millennium Falcon. He says, no, this one goes there, that one goes there. So it's really about the people. It's not about the technology.
That's I definitely could see that. In Dune, I felt like I was meeting, I felt like I was like going to my husband's dinner for the first time and meeting like 50 million relatives at one time. It was just, there were so many introductions in the first few chapters, and it almost like it kept parading on, like character introduction after introduction just kept parading on. I loved how character driven this story was and how we got to get in everybody's heads, even sometimes on the same page, you know, going into different people's heads.
Right.
I laughed when I went back and looked at my opening notes because I had some of the funniest things written. Because, like you said, the characters were just being kind of thrown at you quickly. And I was like, I had Fade Rotha, Harkonnen's darling. Like, I had no idea who this was, but he seems to like him a lot. I think it's him. I don't know. I'm going to write that down.
We'll
figure this out.
Well, I mean, you're better than me. I was just kind of abbreviating and writing for, like, the first initial line and then the last, whatever the last letter of the name was, because that was getting mixed up with character to character. So your notes sound way better organized than I do.
I'm working on it. I'm getting there.
All right, so the novel in general touches on a theme I see in sci-fi a lot, which is the meaning, of course, or the theme of what does it mean to be human? Paul, of course, eventually learns out that he is at least partially Harkonnen. And previously, he didn't believe that the Harkonnens were even human. He's even quoted in here, the Harkonnens, put those twisted humans out of your mind. He stared at his mother, and she replies to him, you shouldn't refer to people as human without, and he interrupts, don't be so sure you know where to draw the line. So did you guys pick up on more elements of that particular theme? And have you seen that in general, not only with this novel, but also with similar ones?
Well, I think in the early novel, the difference between people and human was really, it was really stressed. Paul goes through the Bene Gesserit test with his hand in the box to determine if he's human. And at that point in time, I'm still thinking, well, what's the difference? Aren't they all human? Is there something bred in here? Because we don't know enough about the world at this point in time, the Dune Dune world. Dune, there's a word I'm looking for.
Universe.
Arrakis.
Yeah, Arrakis.
Right.
Or do you mean...
I mean like
the story
the
of...
Canon.
Right. The Dune story universe.
Yeah, like, well, I don't know, maybe there are aliens
Zeitgeist?
In here.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
So I feel like there was all that stress. And then I think part of the beauty of the story is that as it progresses, Paul sees beyond that and embraces the Fremen. And, you know, human is nothing by the end. We're all, anyone can achieve any position by the end of the novel.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. It was funny because I remember reading that same situation where they're kind of like testing him to see, and it made me think of Blade Runner because like the indistinguishable aspect of the people who exist in the future and like they're robotic in that sense, but here it's like it's less kind of that like distinguishable in the sense that like I don't know, my imagination went off on all these tangents. I was like, are there like expanded humans? And then we like learn about, okay, well, they can use like much more formidable brain thought and stuff when they
and is this Battlestar Galactica robots club
right
like, yeah, that's where I started going there too. Yeah, that's exact same here. That's where I started going too. It's like what kind of characters are we talking about here that may or may not be human?
Yeah,
I felt sort of disappointed when it turns out they're all just human. They're just
they're just boring, they're just people.
Right Anyway, it's funny now that we talk about it, there's kind of something to be said in terms of like not being exposed to a different culture and just making like blatant assumptions about it. And I feel like that is definitely rampant throughout the book because from a humanistic perspective, like you kind of make all these assumptions about like who the Harkonnens are and everything along those lines. And like soon to find out, as Russ stated before, that like Paul finds out that he's like part Harkonnen and everything along those lines. And he had made those assumptions previous to that. And so, and I mean, that definitely translates throughout a lot, not just the sci-fi genre. I mean, you see that all over the place in writing.
Right. It definitely had, I felt like it had a bit of the Star Trek, like, everyone is equal. Like, let's bring everything to a blank slate by the end of the story.
Yeah.
At the beginning, you're, oh man, the Harkonnens are terrible, and the Fremen are savages, and it almost felt a bit heavy-handed by the end. We're like, Paul is Harkonnen, and he's leading the Fremen, and what's going on here?
Right.
So I felt like that was an interesting while it was overwhelming towards the beginning of the book, at the end it was a neat wrap up.
Hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
So with the novel in general, I find that the novel gives you the story in a very prophetic way. From the very beginning of the novel, you're set up to consider that maybe the Bene Gesserit are orchestrating this whole thing. You hear some of the songs that are being sung, like the Dirge of Janus, the Fremen that Paul killed. Those prophetic as well. They're, of course, telling what's going to be coming. We're seeing signs of Duke Leto's self-sacrifice early on from the very beginning. So did you pick up on this in the beginning of the novel and try and have a prediction about what it's going to end? And then when it does kind of come up to the ending, was it what you expected?
Well, I'll say the ending for me wasn't what I expected. Going in, just kind of hearing how the Reverend Mother was describing the whole Bene Gesserit, and like when they arrived on Arrakis, how we were hearing about the different missionarias that had gone out there and spread these religions and spread these prophecies, just so that way it could kind of create a little protection for the Bene Gesserit. I thought the novel, the book, was going to go more in a little bit different of a direction. And as I started going along and reading it, I can see how all of that began to come into play, because it makes it so that way Paul can be the, you know, Muad'Dib, and he can, you know, take this mantle of leading the Fremen without that legend having been planted before. It may not have streamlined so easily. But I thought we were going into a little bit different of a direction when I was reading it, you know, from the start and reading how they had planned all that kind of stuff up. You know, it is pretty interesting to see how it all wrapped up in the end, you know, for Paul and for Jessica as they escaped and went on to do their thing.
No, I completely agree. The conclusion of the novel wasn't what I expected. Mm-mm. At the outset. I'm probably 3/4 of the way through. I'm like, yeah, okay, I can see where this is going. But you should probably see that by 3/4 of the way through. But when I think about how this was published in 1965, we've seen this story retold countless times at this point in the game, in 2017. But it had to be pretty surprising then, would be my guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I imagine this probably was a game changer back then.
Right. Right. Even just, as we mentioned previously, having a science fiction novel based on more character-driven rather than technology-driven.
Hmm.
Although I should probably read some more old sci-fi before I speculate.
Yeah, that's true. I always think about kind of like the context when Herbert was writing it. Like, imagine, like, so what, it came out in the mid-60s, but obviously he had this idea before that. And,
right.
I mean, he always stated that his motivation was coming from, like, the government and stabilizing sand dunes or something like that, or whatever it was. But, yeah, like, I mean, obviously, like, peace and love being spread all over the country, at least that was, the mantra. Seeing how, I don't know, it was interesting because, so, what we were just talking about before about how, like, when Paul, like, eventually takes control of the Empire and, like, leads the Fremen, but, like, somewhat doesn't, or kind of isn't able to anymore. And, like, I kind of realizing that at least, like, from their perspective, or at least from his perspective, he could have potentially reached the same conclusion without having, like, the whole, like, prophet backdrop or whatever it was that was created.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I don't know. That for me, that was interesting because it definitely kind of begs this underlying question about what like a prophet does in the role, not only in this book, but also like probably what Herbert was trying to get at, and at least in like the society that was kind of morphing into the New Age movement in the United States for sure.
Yeah, it seemed like Herbert was pretty heavy-handed with some of these ideas, like the whole prophet thing, the environment thing, like, yeah. You know, with the whole changing the planet and changing the ecosystem and the planetologist plan. Like, it really seemed like Herbert was pretty heavy-handed with some of the ideas that he was trying to lay down for people to you know, to pick up.
Right, right.
But that being said, I didn't feel like it felt particularly dated when I listen to it now. Like, heavy-handed, yes, but I feel like as a society we still kind of hold on to those ideals. Like, we should preserve things and we should, you know, work towards this goal, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, the underlying kind of, like, resource like scarcity issue. Every time I read it, I've always been like, oh yeah, Herbert would totally be like in, like supporting like the climate change movement and everything along those lines.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like so obviously like hitting those numbers every single time he's writing throughout all the chapters, even though he's talking about the characters mostly, he always comes back to that.
Yeah.
And so, definitely turned off the water while I brushed.
Now, I'm thinking about that in particular, planetologists and the Fremen and their plan to totally revolutionize the ecology of the planet. And to me, that whole theme almost seems very interpretable, kind of like what I felt in Ender's Game. So with this, we're taking what, and the exact quote, and I'm not sure who said it, but it's that this planet could be an Eden. So yeah. We're planning on completely revolutionizing this planet. The idea, of course, being for the better. Is that something you feel like is pretty black and white, and you get the idea of what Herbert's trying to say with that particular theme? Or is there more evidence there to support, I guess, overall goal behind that theme?
What I mostly read from, a lot of it was like a haves versus have-nots. You know, the haves don't necessarily have the best interest in mind for everybody, whereas the have-nots, you know, they think they do. Mm-hmm. They just don't always have the means to do it, and that breeds a lot of conflict and resentment, you know, between the Fremen and the Harkonnen, but also between, you know, people who believe in climate change and people who don't and all this other stuff. Like, you know, like it was said a minute ago, it's definitely still relevant now because this is kind of one of those things that is human nature, you know, to disagree and on the best use of our resources.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people are always going to control the best of the resources and some are not.
Because I'm thinking about the Fremen, though, extremely frugal with their resources, but for a purpose. They have an end game in mind. Does that relate to... And I guess here's what I really want to ask. I'm not a historian, so I don't really know a lot about what was going on, in particular in the Middle East around the time that this book was being, you know, conceived of and written.
Mm-hmm.
When I first read it, my first thought was, oh, this is a retelling of that movie that came out a few years ago, Charlie Wilson's War. But that story took place in 1979.
It's a retelling of that movie from 15 years from now.
So clearly that wasn't it. I mean, in that movie, of course, Russians are fighting in Afghanistan. And Paul, much like Charlie Wilson, jumps in to try and help out the natives. But that wasn't it at all, because that was a good 15 years later.
Right, right.
So I'm looking at this thinking, well, what was the influence here? I mean, clearly there's a lot of parallels between the Fremen. And is that name not entirely too heavy-handed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all pretty heavy-handed,
perfect.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Jihad. Fremen Jihad, I mean.
Right.
Yeah, they're celebrating Ramadan.
Yeah, like, yeah, that was...
But what is the historical significance there? Do we have... Do any of you guys have any insight into that?
Yeah, I guess to know... I mean, it was released in 65, but I guess to know, we would have to figure out when Herbert conceptualized it. I know he conceptualized Dune... when he went on some sort of trip to Oregon, but when that was and how all these other themes came about, I guess we'd have to know when he was inspired to write Dune. Because even though it was released in 65-ish, you know, maybe it wasn't necessarily focused on what was going on at that time, but maybe a few years before that.
Right.
True.
Yeah. And also, like, I mean, you referenced Oregon. Like, if he's in that area of the country, I mean, of course, I'm speculating because I actually don't really know much of it, like, what motivated him aside from talking about, like, sand dunes and stuff like that. But who knows? In terms of, like, culture clash, having the issues with Native Americans in the United States at the time, I mean, that's, like, a very, very long, contentious issue that's existed for multiple decades. But who knows if that could have been an influence. But, I mean, and at the same time, if we think about, like, what was happening in the Middle of the East, at least somewhat around that time, even then, his motivation for having that kind of difference between... And well, actually, it was funny, what I was thinking about was, if we're looking at it from the perspective of somebody who's using the resource because out of necessity, as opposed to somebody who's using the resource out of economic gain, that like kind of diametrical difference just obviously has existed in all societies for such a long period of time that it kind of made sense. And I really kind of felt that theme throughout the book for sure. Mm.
So perhaps that's it. I mean, here I am not understanding the reference, or not understanding there is no reference because it was 15 years later, and realizing that this is, and maybe that's what makes it such a classic, this is a kind of a timeless tale.
Yeah.
And this is the reference that we're all looking for. It's Dune.
I definitely saw somewhere on the internet while reading about Dune, someone was like, well, this is just George Bush in the Middle East. And I was like, you know, it's really not. Because that was 25 years later, 30 years later. Mm. A good call. I mean, I can see where you're coming from, but no, not in this case. You're right. The reference is Dune. That's not what we're looking for. Mm. But that makes me think of when the Atreides first moved to Arrakis. Remember, Duke Leto wanted to plant 40 extra, or he planted additional trees.
Yes.
And they said that each tree is water for 40 people for a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, they have eight date trees.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think it really spoke volumes to the character, to Duke Leto's character as created by Herbert, that he overcame that and was winning the planet.
Mm.
So one of the things I didn't love about Dune, and I guess I think it speaks to the skill of the author, is that I hated that we knew in advance that Duke Leto was going to die. Mm. And I kept thinking, it's not going to happen. It's really not. He's going to dodge this. And you know it's going to happen, but I keep pretending like it won't. Because he was such a likable, fantastic character.
Yeah.
I really liked Leto. Even though he was only there for...
Early on, you see...
a small portion of the book.
You see him going out of his way to make sure that the workers know that he's really caring for them. You see there's a freighter that's getting attacked by sandworms, and the rescue ship isn't there for them.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, he goes out of way to make sure that we're not leaving any men behind. Damn the spice, save the men, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You see that. Now, the couple of questions I had here, and this is, I'm going to try and tie this all back into Duke Leto here, was first, what was the significance of the fact that the rescue freighter had gone missing? And secondly, later on, we see at his, I guess it was like an inaugural ball or the welcome ceremony, where he dispenses with the old Harkonnen water wasteful...
the hand washing thing?
Ceremony where the beggars can come and get the drippings out of the towel. But then later on at that dinner... he takes his cup and pours it onto the ground.
Yeah, he throws it on the floor.
And I think I had a hard time reading Leto. What was the significance of all of that? Was that all trying to tell me something, or am I just missing something that should be smacking me on the head?
Oh, that's a good question, because I wondered that myself, because I do like Leto. I think he was poised to be a good leader,
mm-hmm.
but that scene, I 100% agree, it was hard to read. I personally, I don't know how anybody else felt about this, but I was getting uncomfortable when they were talking about the whole hand washing and then giving the ring out to the beggars. I was like, damn, that is so messed up. I was getting uncomfortable reading that, and I was happy to see him dispense with the tradition. What I read from the whole throwing the cup of water on the floor thing was kind of like he didn't want to do it, but he had to do the whole there's a new sheriff in town here nobility.
Mm-hmm.
It's
not gonna be the way you like it. If we're gonna waste water, it's gonna be under specific terms, and it's not gonna be terms that are humiliating to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the sense of discomfort for you is what I got. But I could,
yeah, that's the way I read it too. You know, there's a new sheriff in town. We're not going to give beggars our wrung-out hand towels, but, you know, before people get too comfortable thinking he's a pushover, I'll still throw a cup of water. I'm still the ruler here.
Hmm.
But under different terms.
FYI, the water goes my way now. Like, that's kind of how it seemed, you know?
Yeah, that was definitely the impression I got.
And could the trees have tied into that?
I think so. Hmm. And I think he was trying to demonstrate that with new leadership here, we can change a lot about the way your society functions.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit blatant at first. I'm going to plant these trees, but I think it was his way of introducing his new policy. Things are changing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is interesting because you see some traditions like remain, because I felt the same way in terms of like the kind of like rebel without a cause dumping the water. and like, but also thinking of like, okay, so Jessica also does the water of life ritual, which I'm like kind of blanking on maybe the description of whatever that is. But like, and like having the
weird
daughter
spitting on the table.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like still goes through that. And it's this old kind of like ancient tradition for them. But at the same time, I think that he was using that as a way to like show how the daughter can like get the power by drinking, like by her doing the actual like water of life drinking and everything along those lines, and like getting the powers in the womb, but not like meaning to or whatever it was. So for me, it was like he wanted to emphasize that there was a like obviously a rebellion against the traditional cultures, but at the same time, he would like, and him being Herbert, would choose some of the like ones to maintain so that he could kind of continue the story along, and well, also resolve a lot of the information that he gave us in the beginning as well.
So I'm wondering, since you mentioned Aaliyah, Jessica's daughter, mm-hmm. Paul's sister, I'm wondering how much she plays into the later stories, because, and this could be me, but she just felt like sort of a superfluous plot element to me.
That's how I felt about that too.
Okay. I'm glad it wasn't.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is,
was this,
this is
just
a pretty,
display of Paul's wondrous powers and perceptions, or
yeah.
Right.
You're right. That did feel pretty,
like, this is a pretty cool element. Okay, she was pregnant when she did the Water of Life ceremony, and now she has this weird little kid, but the weird little kid didn't really, I mean, she slayed Baron Harkonnen in the end, but, you know, you could have had a wall fall on him and just eliminated that entire character.
Yeah, that's true.
I felt like it was a harsh read on my part, but I was also, yeah, she's kind of annoying. I'm not really into her.
Yeah, she was not only, I didn't find her particularly annoying, I found her almost uncomfortable. And I feel like everyone else was very uncomfortable around her as well.
Well, and maybe Herbert had a point with that. Maybe that's what he was going for. I just didn't feel like I had a full resolution for that conflict.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe that comes in the later novels.
It could be. Could it also have something to do with the novel's general abandonment of computers? I mean, we talk about technology, but really outside of like, you know, ornithopters, there isn't much in the way of technology that is being utilized here. And computers completely abandoned for the sake of being human. And,
right.
Of course, we saw that very similar theme in, as was mentioned earlier, Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
So is that us getting kind of a glimpse, going further, of course, into what it means to be human, but is seeing Paul's sister in that way, is that us getting a glimpse as to what it means to go even above and beyond? Because she could be one step beyond your normal Bene Gesserit or your normal Mentat.
It could be. It could be. I mean, I mm-hmm. think that if you follow the novel to its conclusion, she would, at this point in the game, after having just read the first book, I mean, she would be the evolutionary standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That it would be leading towards.
And so would Paul.
Yeah, Paul
yeah.
and Aaliyah in, through extrapolation. But, yeah. I don't know. She seemed like a cool idea that really didn't have much of a point.
It could well be that does get fleshed out in later novels.
Right, yeah.
Is anybody inspired to read, if I could ask, is anybody else inspired to read more of the following ones? I personally would like to read Dune one more time before I decide whether I'm going to continue, because I don't know if I absorbed as much from, you know, this reading as what I wanted to.
So I would totally be inspired. I'm a big reader. Russ listens to audiobooks. I like paper or Kindle, which is not at all paper. But anyway, I like to see the text.
With your eyes.
With my eyes. I struggled with Dune.
Yeah, I did too. My mom watched the movie, and because she was excited, I told her, you know, we're going to talk about it, and you know, I'm going to be able to break it down a little better. And she was like, oh, it came on the other day, and I was going to watch it, and I couldn't get into it. And I was like, well, I like the book so far. It is a hard read. It is definitely not one of your just blow through it and, you know, you'll finish quickly and understand everything quickly. It's not one of those. You got to be married to the story.
You're going
to
be focused and concentrating. Our friend Julie was reading this, and I believe her end verdict was, life is too short for me to finish this book. You know, fair enough. But then I said, you know, I listened to it, and it really does have a great resolution. I really liked the last two-thirds of the book. I liked the first third. It was just thick.
Right.
Yeah.
And I said, you should, it's really good. She's like, yeah, but, you know.
Yeah, I did the audiobook thing because I was having trouble getting through, you know, reading it in its entirety. So I ended up finishing off the last half or so with an audiobook and listening to it.
Yes.
I was able to absorb a lot more, maybe because I wasn't so focused on all those names.
Mm. I think it made it much easier. Yeah. I was stumbling over pronunciation and, yeah, this was my morning walk listen. Which worked really well.
If you're a reader, you do focus on whether or not you're reading it properly and pronouncing it properly. It's something that just sometimes can kind of bug you. So it was a hard read to use the eyes, but to use the ears, it was a lot better to do. And like I said, I'll go through it again.
Right.
Then I'll decide whether or not I'm interested in the story enough to continue into the Duneverse, you know?
Yeah, exactly. For me, I've heard that Children of Dune is actually a really good read as well, which is after Dune Messiah. But in terms of like the density of the book, like it would be interesting, I guess, maybe to go back and read it when it first came out and wasn't considered kind of like this foundational sci-fi novel, and then like kind of interpret it from that view. But yeah, so here it's like coming across it because, oh, okay, I'm going to read this now because I need to know these things to be like the good sci-fi nerd that I am. And
I need to understand what they're talking about on Futurama, damn it. So, like, I need to.
Like, I need to, like, force myself to get through this and, like, okay, I'm going to get really invested in the characters and, like, pay attention. And then, like, afterwards you're like, all right, well, like, gave us all that information, resolved, like, 60% of it, which can be a little frustrating, but maybe he was planning on writing more beyond that, which he ended up doing anyways. But yeah, no, I kind of, if I had a critique of Dune itself and then maybe something that might inhibit me reading any of the other novels in the future is that, okay, I have this foundation. I understand what Herbert was trying to get at. I understand what it did for the genre, but now I can maybe branch out and read other novels as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like he, and I'm not going to say he started it, but it seems like this is one of those novels that's like the great one type theme. Like, because we have the great one in Luke Skywalker, we have the great one in Harry Potter, and the great one, Percy Jackson, of course, the great and wonderful Ender Wigan. You know, it seems like this is one of those that kicks off that young guy who's going to be a great one and struggle and have a heavy burden placed on him and face some pretty frightening and deep questions in humanity. That's what I got from this is like, I look at it, I'm like, oh, well, this, I could see how this was a foundation for a genre because this and this are all present. Mm-hmm. And this is a very early novel. So
I agree. I completely agree. I feel like the pacing was sort of strange for me though, in light of this being sort of a coming of age, you know, young man rising to the top to build an empire novel. There was so much focus on him with his father beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And then like chapters about when they met the Fremen. And then it just skipped ahead to like, yeah, he married Chaney and had a kid. Now he's going to take over.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like we missed the part of that. Like that would be the movie montage part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Waxing on, waxing off.
It did kind of make an abrupt turn. You know, the circumstances that forced the entire family to be destroyed and the tooth and Duke Leto. And then all of a sudden he's with the Fremen running for his life. It took an abrupt left-handed turn and then just, and here we are 10 years later.
And look at this. Now he's king of the Fremen.
It was unusual pacing. Yeah. I'll give you that. Now, you had mentioned, of course, the one, the chosen one, the hero, the Neo and Morpheus and millions of others that we see in pop culture now. I think that theme has got to come.
Quetzalcoatl.
The Quetzalcoatl. And I would love to know. Well, yeah. I'm doing the Scott Brick here, Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah.
Although Bruce Dickinson in the Iron Maiden song pronounces it the exact same way.
Maybe he listened to Scott Brick.
It's Probably he did not, because that song was written in the 80s, but I don't know for a fact.
Maybe it was about Bush and the oil, though. You don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
Reason I bring that up is because I'm sure that has got to be a theme that comes, just like with Star Wars, from mythology. I mean, we see characters like that in Achilles and Hercules,
yeah.
And it's not exactly the same, but it is similar. There's got to be more in there from ancient literature.
There's the Bible, like, you know, kind of a little, you know, you see how Jesus comes and he's the mm-hmm. chosen one and he struggles, and we see this theme happening, you know, kind of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Now, from a literary perspective, now this is something that may not be quite as old, and here's my question I had about it. Of course, we mentioned that this is a novel with, you described it as thick, an extremely intricate plot. Lots of characters, lots of goings on, lots of moving pieces. And I'm starting to see that this is becoming more and more mainstream, especially with television. Television is becoming much more intricate than it ever was before. But
true.
With novels, I think that is just becoming more popular as well. So if we're reading this in entertainment, kind of our own accord, these devious, twisted plots that are becoming commonplace, why is it that 50 years ago, when the novel was written, the character of Vladimir Harkonnen had to kind of spell out everything to the audience through the fourth wall? Is it that this was the vanguard of stories like this and kind of had to have that James Bond plot moment? Or was there something else there?
I don't know. Do you think Herbert just didn't trust us to understand?
I mean, I don't know. He trusted us with an awful lot of other things. Why is it that... that one needed to be kind of given to us on a silver platter?
Right.
Well, I know young adult wasn't necessarily a genre at that time, mm-hmm. but I mean, I would say this is kind of one of those young adult books, so maybe that's who it was geared for, even though the genre wasn't quite there,
mm-hmm.
wasn't quite as big as it is now. Maybe that's who this was geared for, was the young adult who may not be able to connect all those dots as that we can, now that this plot's been done so many times as adults, we can recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
It might just be that at that point in time, the readers weren't expecting quite that level of intricacy, and they needed it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He was also doing quite a lot of two-timing, that Harkonnen guy. He was doing quite a lot of bouncing around there.
He's a shady character, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But look at, like, we've read some Agatha Christie lately. You know, that was pretty classic plot, 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 and then here are your two chapters to summarize
mm-hmm.
all the stuff you missed.
Mm-hmm.
So it could just be that that was...
It's possible.
Now.
Yeah, right. And also you think of, like, exposure at that time, too. I mean, we were able to list off countless stories that are very similar. And, like, I mean, think of, like, the Twilight Zone being revolutionary
Right.
People are like, oh, my goodness, like, this is crazy. And then, like, getting to this, I'm sure when people picked this book up and it became so popular, it's just, like, they were probably just, like, blown away. There's a good comic stand-up that always references the Transformers movies, and he's like, yeah, if they played the Transformers movies in, like, the 1920s, people's, like, heads would explode.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be able to handle that, like, massive amount of technology just being, like, directed right into their brain. So I think that's definitely a factor into it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I was wondering, is that indicative of the fact that these stories that are just ridiculously complicated, they're popular now. And they were not 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, like, being able to deconstruct it on so many different levels, like, you can go online, obviously, and look up anything on YouTube, and somebody will explain something to you that you
that
don't
understand. That is true.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
That's true.
I literally just did that today because I was having a conversation about the difference between Rogue One and Episode 7 for Star Wars, and, like, why people are saying that one's better than the other.
Hmm.
And this guy just literally goes into, like, the most detailed explanation about, like, the writing and the scripts and the character development and stuff I would never have thought of just watching those two movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's kind of an example of exposure to information.
We have a lot more free time on our hands now.
Yeah.
I can handle a complex plot.
Yeah.
Or I should be able to handle a complex plot.
And if you can't handle it, you can find someone who will explain it to you so you can appreciate it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I have a question for you.
Yes.
you mentioned A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
We're talking George Martin.
Mm. Okay, so...
Who's our chosen one? I know you're a big Bran fan. Are you still holding on to that?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
Okay.
No, he's the guy, although people do say that Ice and Fire is Jon and Daenerys.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, okay, so Sam, Andrew, can I assume that you guys have read A Song of Ice and Fire?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. No, I haven't read A Song of Ice and Fire.
Okay.
It's fantastic, and you should. However,
I started, much like
Dune, I highly recommend watching a few episodes of the show so you know who's talking in the beginning.
Yeah.
It's a little thick.
Watch the first season of the show.
Okay.
Or maybe not the whole first season, just the first half of the first season.
The first couple episodes, just so you know.
Give you some context.
Who these characters are, because if you just dive right in, there's a lot going on. It's
thick. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if it's just coincidental. I don't remember. Y'all haven't mentioned A Song of Ice and Fire, but I was reading Game of Thrones right when we were starting to read Dune, and I ended up putting that one down because all the names were between the two books, all the names were throwing me off, and they are kind of in some way similar. So I was like, oh, I'm going to put this one down. But I didn't even realize that this one was going to be on the checklist for your discussion. I definitely would have read through it a little bit more if I would have known that.
Well, it's more that I've just picked up on a couple of similarities that hit you over the head, and then you start digging a little deeper, and there's a lot in there. So I have a laundry list, and if you'd like, let me ask you guys how you want to do this. I can either just go through this laundry list, or I can ask you guys what you think, and I'll just fill in the blanks afterward. What do you guys want to do?
Laundry list is fine. I mean, we can discuss it. But yeah, there are a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Are they really? Well, go through the list.
I'm sorry, earmuffs if you're...
Okay, so A Song of Ice and Fire in Space. Here. All right, so the story. here's a major family asked to leave their home to take over Imperial duties, and they are killed in the process. The son survives unknown to the enemy and comes later to avenge the father. Duke Leto says, we either win or we die. And, of course, the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. The family houses. Every family house has an animal sigil. There's a grandfather, an old patriarch, that was killed by a wild beast. Duke Leto is said to always pay his debts. House leaders killed very early on, and then later on, the rest of the house reunites.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. The Three-Eyed Raven, very similar to the Quetzalcoatl. Plans within plans within plans, something that was mentioned and said, so very similar to what you see out of Peter Baelish.
Right.
Marriage to seal a political deal, which, of course, is very common with, ancient political, even, on Earth.
Right.
But we see that branch out into these two stories. Paul Harkonnen. Paul is a Harkonnen the same way that, oh, shoot, Sam, earmuffs.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, that's a big one.
Okay. No listening for me. Because this is so weird that it came up because I noticed one or two similarities as I was reading the chapters, which is why I put it down.
Okay, well, I'll just say this. Paul is the Harkonnen, the same as the major reveal we all learned last season.
Okay, but I didn't see it, so I'm good.
Yep.
I didn't watch the show. Is it confirmed? Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to know so bad.
I know you don't, do you?
It's really, really worth the payoff.
It is so worth it.
Don't spoil anything.
Yeah.
No, it's cool. It's cool. I will definitely, I'll get through it. Now I just want to blow through it. This book was given to me many moons ago, and I never got around to reading it until coincidentally these two came up side by side. Yeah. So now I'm really excited about this
one.
And I'm in that, like, give me all the characters, and I want to write down all the notes mode, so.
Right.
And we can get at it.
All right, and I got two more for you here. We got Varys and his cohorts are, of course, acting like shadow agents, kind of orchestrating the whole plot in much the same way that you see the Bene Gesserit doing. And then, of course, we have a major character in A Song of Ice and Fire who is considered to perhaps be Azor Ahai in the same way that Paul Atreides is Muad'Dib Quetzalcoatl.
Mm.
So that's my laundry list. What did I miss?
No, that's a pretty good list, I think.
That is, yeah.
I'm sure you've missed things.
Oh, I'm sure there's lots. You know what? We got to go to YouTube and find out what I missed.
That's true.
Exactly. Well, I was thinking about like the timeline in terms of when Dune came out. And like I know in the interviews that I've seen with Martin, he's always talked about how big of a comic book fan and sci-fi fan he was growing up. So like, I mean, he must have been in his teen, like a teenager or something, somewhere around then when that came out. So I'm sure that he
was probably 42. I'm pretty sure he's 165 right now.
Yeah. He's been writing for 165 years, but he's not that old.
He's never going to finish.
He's immortal.
Oh, I hope so, because I'd really like him to finish the books.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I don't think it's happening.
We shall see.
It could happen.
I almost get the impression like his whole thing was, I just want to make a television show. How could I do that?
A Song of Ice and Fire because he wanted to write something that was too expensive to film.
Hmm.
And then technology caught up to him.
There you go.
Is that the opposite of George Lucas?
I think so.
Right.
Hey, yeah, just slap it together. Is it going to look good? All right, we're cool.
Or maybe what Dune was, because the movie ended up being so terrible.
Oh, yes. Okay, so let's...
But you said Patrick Stewart was in the movie, right?
Patrick Stewart, yeah. And Sting.
But
and
you never,
somebody else.
You never told me which characters they were, because I was like, I'm going to watch the movie. Don't spoil it, because I'm big on not spoiling.
I'm glad you don't remember, but I did tell you. If you listen to...
You did tell
bonus
me.
Material on one of our previous episodes.
Bonus material.
Do you remember I told you to look up that picture of Fade Rautha?
He's not Fade Rautha. Patrick Stewart is not Fade
no,
Rautha.
No, Patrick is Stewart is a Sting is Fade Rautha.
Oh, all right.
And Sam, you were talking about the movie with Patrick Stewart and Sting, right? Not the miniseries, right?
Yeah, I was talking about the movie. I couldn't get through it. The movie was, to me, it was just terrible.
I couldn't get through it either. I've heard the miniseries is better, but still not good.
I didn't know there was a miniseries. I want to check that out. I feel like something needs to do this story justice, because like I said, it's got so many good characters and people that you want to meet and get to know more about. These people would be awesome to see portrayed, in a better way than that tragedy that was doing the movie.
Yes.
Right.
I had tried to watch that one in chapters, but because I kept falling asleep.
Mm.
Good sign, right?
But that magic line, I tell you, if I see it was inspired by, based on the novel, blah, 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 I will almost always go check the book out just to see.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
The book had to be good if they planned to make a movie out of it, is my general line of thinking.
Exactly.
The Ruins.
Was the book good?
No, my goodness, no. The book was awful. No, I didn't even see the movie. Did you read The Ruins?
I did not.
I didn't read it, but I saw the movie.
Was the movie bad?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It works. So I liked it a lot, Dune. I'm glad that I finished it, is the way I feel. And it really, even being as old as it was, it still seemed fresh. I still enjoyed the story, even though I can definitely see where a lot of modern sci-fi is borrowing from it and using similar themes. I liked Dune a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I came out on this.
Yeah, I agree as well. And it was kind of like rereading it again. It was a nice refresher because the majority of the sci-fi, like modern sci-fi reading that I do, it's so technologically heavy and very, very scientifically based. Like, so I'm reading the Expanse series right now, which there's also a television show, but they go into the minutiae of every type of physics, space, rockets, ships, aspects, everything, like motion, everything along those lines. They just get so detailed, and I love it, and it's great. And like, I mean, I think a lot of people lauded The Martian for being that as well, because it was so realistic and scientifically based. But at the same time, it was kind of like a nice counterpart to like reread Dune and be like, oh yes, right, there are people living in these worlds that these people are creating.
That's such a good summation of a lot of sci-fi. Sometimes you should put people in there and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. And like even in The Expanse, like they kill off people and I'm like, oh, all right. Well, then again, maybe I'm desensitized from Fire and Ice, but...
Yeah. Don't get attached, by the way, when you read to anyone.
Like, right. But even
I've heard, don't get attached to anybody because the minute you love them, there they go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like Duke.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I liked Duke.
I mean, he was a little bit of a tough read, probably because I think all leaders are in some way, shape, or form tough reads. But I liked him, so and then he had to go, and that makes me sad. They always kill the ones we love.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember, like, probably 3/4 of the way through the book, I thought, man, if Duke Leto had just lived, none of this would even be happening.
Yeah.
Which book would be over.
Book would be done.
Just like Eddard Stark.
Yeah.
Right.
And I often wonder just about literature or stories in general, is that you have to stretch your disbelief a little bit to make sure that you can appreciate the book. But I've always thought that, well, if we're watching we're appreciating a story, whether it's a book, a television show, a movie, an audiobook, whatever, if we're appreciating a story, are we going to be entertained by a story that we believe 100%?
Oh, no.
If it was a completely believable story, is it going to be even remotely entertaining?
I don't think it would be. I think you're right in that suspension of belief for a little while has to make it entertaining.
And that, I think that can be much like a rubber band. It's useless if it's not stretched.
Yeah.
But at some point, it snaps, and as soon as it snaps, it's useless, and it can never be used ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find that my rubber band is getting smaller and thinner as I age.
Well, I think that that's why we have a variety of different types of literature or stories in general. I mean, there are some stories where you have to, like fantastic stories that you really have to believe in the universe in order to appreciate. But then there are writers, and I believe Anton Chekhov is probably the best example of this, that write a slice of life that just fits. And I think a lot of people who would appreciate more fantastic literature would probably be very bored by Anton Chekhov. But with a smaller, tighter rubber band, perhaps you ought to reread The Brothers Karamazov, or that was Chekhov, right? Or Anna Karenina. Yeah, that one.
That one. Perhaps
that wasn't Chekhov, though, was it?
I thought it was. I'm probably totally wrong.
Yeah, I like that you made the reference, though. I like that you put it out there.
I'm trying. So let me ask you this. Is there anything else that we have that we missed? Anything else we need to discuss about Dune? We're coming up on about an hour.
No, I think we got pretty well into it, analyzed it pretty deeply. Sure. Overall, it's one of those books that you're going to give a mixed review on because there's so much to digest, but you still want to go back for more. You still want to give it another reread.
Very willing to reread this now that I understand the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be better the second time around. I think it's one of those books that's better the second time around. And if it's better the second time, you never know. It might be better the third time or further in series down the line.
I would definitely continue to read down this in the series if I were reading Outlander, but I won't. So.
I imagine similar to a good movie or a Harry Potter or anything that's got a lot of depth to it, you're going to pick up on new things every time that you read it.
Oh, I think it would be rewarding the second time through.
Yeah.
Or the third time.
Fire and Ice, too. That's like, there's a really good comparison there. Right. I mean,
yeah. I was just going to say, I'm going to reread it in the form of Fire and Ice. So that's going to be the way that I I get into that character analysis.
Yeah. I think I read A Game of Thrones 5 times and still got new things each time. So maybe you should leave the audiobooks on my device.
Yeah.
All right.
He's just going to switch them out for, what are we reading?
In the White City.
The Devil in the White City, which is also fantastic, but a little thick in parts, the architecture bits.
We'll
talk about that in an upcoming episode.
Another one that was very heavy on names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
People, though.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing.
All right. So with that being it for Dune, I'll give us an opportunity to roundtable. Go ahead and everybody tell us what you're reading now, what you think we ought to read in the future, and what else you've been up to outside of books, anything that we ought to be checking out or anything you'd like us to know. Andrew, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, so wrapping up, I think the mixed reviews are probably the most accurate, at least from my perspective, of how I felt like finishing the book and really the massive amount of information, and also not having gone on and read the rest of the books. Maybe we're all doing a little bit of a disservice to the book, but at the end of the day, I wouldn't blame anybody if they did the same thing I did before. As for books that I'm reading right now, actually relating back to Ender's Game, they just released the newest installment for the second Formic Wars. And so that I'm just starting to begin that, and now it's with Card, and he's writing it in conjunction with Aaron Johnson, who's a screenwriter. But anyways, yeah, so I would recommend it, but I haven't gotten through the first chapter. So, but I do recommend the first Formic War books, which were great. So, those are my recommendations.
Nice.
And Samantha?
I just found the third part in the Ransom Riggs trilogy, the Miss Peregrine trilogy.
Oh, do you like those?
So I'm very excited about that. I shelved it until I was done with Dune, but now I'm ready to get into that one, and I'm going to read that one alongside Game of Thrones. But I was very excited to see that. I don't know if any of y'all have read the Miss Peregrine of those, but they're really good. I enjoyed them.
They've been on my list for quite some time, though. So yeah, it's good to hear them recommended personally.
Absolutely, absolutely. The third, like I said, the third one just came out. I think it's called Library of Souls. So I've got that lined up, ready to roll. And then, like I said, I'm going to go back to Game of Thrones. I'm only like maybe 3 chapters or so in, so I'm like barely scratching the surface of that one. But every time I open it, it's tough for me to put it down. So
he's a fantastic author.
Looking forward to that. Those are what I have on my reading list for now.
Tara?
So I am about halfway through The Devil in the White City. It is a really good book, but we'll talk about that in another podcast. Yeah, I'm messing around with Outlander because I have a new book in that I haven't read, so it seemed really smart of me to go back and reread the beginning of the series, which is only like, 30,000 pages or so. So great decision on my part. Oh, I just got our oldest son the Hobbit graphic novel, which I've seen recommended many times. And it really is beautiful to look at upon first inspection. So we're going to start reading that soon.
Ooh,
we were reading the actual Hobbit, and his interest was sort of waning. I don't know why.
He seems to be into Chronicles of Narnia.
Are you reading that with him? Maybe we're pouring too much on them all at once.
Could be. I'm getting a little confused. Wait, what did Bilbo do to the White Witch?
Yeah,
that's right. How I was feeling when I was reading Game of Thrones and Dune together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I was feeling.
When I finished Dune, I was so pleased with myself. Like, way more pleased with myself than I should have been. I wanted, like, some sort of sci-fi nerd badge. Like, look at me.
We should make one of
Dune.
Those. I would wear one of those because I would get one whenever I sit and watch the Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
I would get, like, I want a nerd badge for every time that I hit, like, so
get, like,
many XP.
It could be like a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout thing, right? You could sew on your buttons or your badges.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's probably an Etsy shop already.
The one thing I've noticed is that, like, when you have conversations with other people and, like, if it ever comes up or any reference of it comes up, there's kind of this like, mutuality between the two of you, and you're like, oh, whoa, like, you got through that as well? Like, that's great.
Hey, nerd bro, let's talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, fellow soldier of the nerd war, what's up?
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. So, yeah, maybe, like, pins or badges.
Yeah, I totally dig that. I like that idea.
I think it's good. Then you can recognize each other from a distance when you're at, like, a nerd.
Like, we unite.
What are you reading, Daddy?
Well, actually, what I got to mention is I have suffered one of the hugest disappointments I have felt in a long, long time.
Just stop. Stop with this.
The ending to The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild was devastatingly bad.
But he played like 80 hours of the game.
That only makes it worse.
Yeah.
I mean, if you sit through a 2-hour movie and the ending's bad, whatever.
But 80 hours,
this is 80 hours of gameplay on the epitome of video game adventures, and it just ended on.
It seemed fine. I watched it.
You don't.
Did it just like fall flat?
Oh yeah, and abrupt ending that was just kind of hastily thrown together.
Interesting.
Yeah,
because, like, I remember how frustrating the water temple was, like, back in the original, and, like, but at least it was like an amazing, like, again, triumphant, like, feeling at the end. So
yeah.
I guess if this one kind of falls, that's too bad.
And I had just finished Twilight Princess, which is one of my other favorites, and I wasn't sure about the ending on that. There was something I was, like, so fixated on this one point that didn't make a lot of sense, and I only realized after playing it again that that one point is just a minor thing, and the rest of the ending of Twilight Princess is super good. So I'm going into this one, but a mere 2 months later, and I'm stoked. I'm excited, ready for what they're going to throw at me and everything, and especially because everything leading up to that point was terrific. That when you hit that point, it just decimated me. So kind of been on a downer lately. So much, but oh, I can.
You really have. That explains so much.
That's one of many things that's bringing me down.
Moment of silence for the latest Zelda ending. Like that's sad.
It really yeah. seemed fine to me, though.
But to bring it on an up note, I can tell you that Adam Neville's book, The Ritual, is genuinely terrifying. And something, unlike House of Leaves, I think something that you could at least approach.
Oh, mm. I would be willing to.
Very similar to Dune in the way that it, you're reading one novel and then all of a sudden, boom, you're reading another novel, which was kind of weird. But the payout in the end, he does wrap it all up together, and the payout was pretty decent. Certainly wasn't the best thing I've ever read in my life, but I enjoyed it very much, so much so that I would reread it and would recommend it.
I love me a good scary book, too. Yes. I love good scary novels.
You
this one's pretty good.
You
so
would,
that's a pretty ringing endorsement.
I rarely reread. I reread all the time. Audiobooks. I reread audiobooks all the time.
This was an actual physical book that you held in your hands, though.
Yes, I was unable to get this one on audio. But not only that, but I also finished it in less than 3 weeks, which is like super sprint pace for me.
That's like... doing something in some parsecs or something, right?
And that's the risk that you run if you're not appropriating your technobabble. And then you got to do some retcon to kind of fix it, which, I mean, it makes sense in the universe, but I think that's the only reason the hyperdrive works that way.
Oh, no. We have different nerd things. I can only wear, like, half of a Star Wars badge.
That's enough.
All right.
Any final comments before I close this out?
No, it's just been a pleasure to have a discussion about it. It's a great book to break down. It's been a pleasure talking with everybody.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a lot of fun.
So our next episode is going to be Eric Larson's The Devil in the White City, which is, as Sarah had mentioned, a terrific book. We'll be recording that one very shortly. And then we're always looking for suggestions on what we should read next. We just did two sci-fis right in a row, so I'm going to want to try and do something a little different for a little while.
Yeah, we talked about some Mary Roach.
Yep.
We could do Mary Roach.
But as always, we're open for suggestions, and thank you guys very much for joining.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. A Novel Podcast at gmail.com or @A Novel Podcast. Look forward to hearing from you.